Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello!
Hello.
Well, here we are. Welcome. It's our Christmas special
slash
edition
birthday.
Of Reasons. It's what?
Slash birthday.
Well, yeah, because your birthday's Christmas Eve.
It is, exactly, yes.
It's a double presents for
yeah,
you.
You got me very nice presents.
You got me a very nice present.
Oh.
Ed got me a vegan cheese making kit.
You got everyone yeah. should have one.
I've two. Just in case.
Yeah. I should explain who's here and why we're here.
Why?
I think it's
I don't think there's an easy answer to the
no, not really.
Question.
I think we're calling it an annual tradition.
We are. Every family, like every family in the country, in the land.
Class struggle. This is a board game that Ed played as a boy. It was invented by a Marxist academic.
Who went bust, apparently.
Yeah, he totally went bust.
And it's an alternative to Monopoly. Yeah. So we're gathered around the kitchen table. And with us, we should say, who we're delighted to be joined by. First, Josie Rourke, who is... You're a friend of Ed's in real life.
In real life?
Yeah.
Not just in podcast land.
It's fiction. We pretend it's Christmas.
As opposed to, I don't guess you have to pretend to be a friend.
We will.
Josie has just directed Mary Queen of Scots, which is going to be out in the pictures any day now. Was there any point at which you thought about casting Ed as anything?
Well, we discussed this.
Yeah, this is a sore point, actually. He was going to...
I was going to be an extra.
...come and be an extra in the court of Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
And then I decided it would be, A, distracting, and B, I'd never made a film before. And the idea that people would just be gawping at Ed while I was trying to work out how to be a film director.
And I couldn't grow a big enough beard, we also thought.
It's actually worse than I asked my mum along, so my mum and dad come along, right? So the first day of shooting, the first day to see me shooting, I'm about 2 weeks in, and, you know, they put cans on and stand by the monitors, and I expect that they're going to see me direct a few takes and just go, we're really proud of you, kid, dead well done. And we do three takes of Margot Robbie being Elizabeth I. And I take my cans off and look expectantly at my mother, and she goes... The second one. Out. Go back home.
She's got the makings of a great producer. That's what she's got there.
Also with us is David Runciman from the Talking Politics podcast. Now, I was in the library with my toddler a couple of weeks ago, and I was reading him a story, and somebody came over and said, excuse me, I recognise your voice. Are you Jeff Lloyd from the Reasons to be Cheerful podcast? I said, yes. He said, I'll tell you what podcast I really like, and you should get him on, though, is Talking Politics. And then I just had to listen to him wax lyrical about you for about 20
been
minutes.
You've had runaway success this year.
By advocating votes for not
six
quite
olds.
Toddlers.
No,
I thought you were going to say they came up and said, these kids are all going to get the vote soon.
But six-year-olds.
Six-year-olds, yeah, that was the line.
Got you a lot of
silence.
Attention.
Yeah.
How's your six-year-old demographic for the podcast listenership?
Good, I think. Good, yeah.
I did a play set in a polling station. They'd have to obviously lower the booth, wouldn't they? Or they could stand on each other's shoulders and put an overcoat on.
They would. They would.
Overcoat is one of the classic signs of voter fraud.
And you are hearing my friend, the comedian, director. You're a polymath these days.
You're friends in real life.
I do many maths. Yeah, we're friends in real life.
Yeah.
IRL.
Yeah. Chris Addison, and a lot of popular culture is missing from Ed.
Gordon Brown ate my 90s.
And so...
I don't think you can blame Gordon Brown for never switching the telly on.
Maybe that's true.
But I asked Ed about the thick of it, in which, of course, you played Ollie Reader, and Ed said it's too painful for you to watch
far
the thick of
too
it.
Too painful.
Well, I mean, you know, I can understand that it's far too painful for me to watch politics.
Yeah. What is the thing where you sit around saying whether we're doing this for the bat people?
Have I the got quiet bat people.
The quiet bat people.
Which comes up. That's one of the things that gets tweeted at me most often because it's the one that sounds most like regular things.
It
that
really
people,
does. Hardworking families.
Little.
It starts with hardworking families.
It starts with hardworking
families. And it ends with the
quiet bat people.
The quiet bat people.
So we're going to play Class Struggle, and we're going to intersperse it with, we have put some topics into, we were supposed to be a Christmas stock shocking, but I'm not quite sure what this receptacle is. And we're going to draw out topics and try and find reasons to be cheerful.
We're going to trans down brand.
Yeah, we're going to find reasons to be optimistic for the end of the year.
You can listen to lots of review podcasts that will say the world is really shit. And it's getting worse, and it's still
like
terrible.
Mine,
yeah,
like,
I didn't really want to say, but and so we're trying to be the alternative, aren't we, Jeff?
Yes.
Although it's going to be a stretch.
Let's see. So, do you want to talk us through class struggle for anybody who wasn't listening to last year's episode?
Yeah, let's start cheery.
Well, this is about the workers and the capitalists. We're going to roll dice. We've got to decide, first of all, who is the palest white male?
Palest, whitest.
I think
malest.
It might be you, Jeff.
Yeah. I think Chris and I are both quite pale.
I've got, you've got quite rosy cheeks.
You're ruddy of cheek, aren't you?
Yes. I think you're pale, so you get to roll first and work out who you are.
It's not got numbers on it, by the way. It's got the various symbols. It seems to be a top hat with a dollar sign on it.
That is extremely bad news for all of us, I think.
Right, Jeff's the capitalist.
Yeah,
Jeff's going to be fine. He's terrible with money.
Jeff is the capitalist. Now, who's the next palest?
We should say
that this isn't something we've made up. It's in the rules that to reflect,
it wants to reflect white privilege.
The palest white male should
not just reflect white privilege, but apparently
reinforce
it on the game. I've got
you're the worker.
I'm the worker.
So what does that mean?
What about a worker, Jeff? What about a worker?
Yeah.
What's that?
You are the farmer.
Am I?
Yeah. Presumably I'm next, am I?
I think you're more privileged than I am.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I look like the shopkeeper.
Attaché case.
What's the attaché? Diplomatic servant.
What's that?
I'm the professional class.
Professional class?
Oh. On the board.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
This is the game you played all the time as a child?
All the time, yeah.
Not really reflected in your knowledge of the game.
No, it isn't. No.
Okay, so the first square is class struggle begins. So I go six spaces. Growth in church attendance. Workers, one debit.
I think it's only if the worker lands on the square.
What happened there is that Jeff threw a dice, moved six places, and nothing happened.
Correct.
But church attendance went up.
Yeah, church attendance went up. Right.
From memory, this is how this is going to play out for the next 6 hours.
Things don't just happen like that, you see, in social change.
I'm in show business and just continue
it. The tectonic plates take a long time to shift.
Shall we pause to pick out a topic and try and find a reason to be cheerful?
Yeah.
Josie, do you want to go first?
Does that say America?
It does say America, yeah.
We're not in it.
So I feel about America that it's a great country, fantastic people, amazing diversity, terrible politics. So if the politics was good, if they got rid of that half-assed constitution, if they kind of tried a real democracy, just think what that
country
could do.
You want to get rid of the constitution?
If you just think what a great country America would be if it had serious functioning politics.
Give us one thing that you would
take the money out.
Lobbying. Yeah.
Is that a constitutional matter?
Yes, it's make it possible so that electoral politics works, stop the states from gerrymandering.
Right.
And reform it, invigorate it, update it.
I mean, there are reasons to be optimistic about America because Trump's in trouble.
Yeah.
Midterms, bad.
People always say Trump's in trouble.
Like every day on Twitter, somebody says, here it
we
is.
We got him.
It's
got
the smoking gun.
Have we? Because one of the things is he goes, no. Because shame is dead, he'd be gone long before if shame was still actually a functioning emotion. But it seems it left on a ship in the night about 18 months ago. And now he is happy just to, that's not me. No, I will say the direct opposite. And you can hold up all the evidence in front of me whilst I'm saying it. I'll still deny the thing that is happening. So it's very difficult to sort of to get rid of it.
I think some of the most vivid debates I've had about identity I've had with Americans in America over the past 12 months. And that's been, an incredibly intellectually positive thing. We've got a great play running at the Donmar at the moment that Lynn Nottage has written. She spent 2 years in Reading, Pennsylvania, trying to work out what happened there to the steel industry.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm going to see it, Sweat.
Yes. I mean, I'd say this modestly because I didn't direct it, but it's a gigantic hit, and I think there is an appetite for people, as well as bemoaning where America is politically, delving into the politics of identity around America and trying to work out what that has to do with our own lives here. I think it's quite vivid in positive ways as well as negative ways.
And it's exciting watching people be engaged and energised in opposition to something. Even it shakes it feels like some complacency has been shaken out of folk in America by Trump, and that is reflected in the midterm results to an extent, and also in some of the people who have been elected there, the kind of people who you're not used to seeing as part of mainstream American politics, which is fantastic. And, you know, Godspeed, a similar thing here.
And the Democratic primaries are going to be thrilling, right?
Absolutely thrilling. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I like this guy, Beto O'Rourke,
who
didn't win in Texas but did very well. But I think partly because he's found a way of doing the opposite of the Trump. He's not trying to be the Trump of the left. He's trying to find a different way of unifying the country, as a platitude, but of trying to sort of talk in a more
open,
but also not in such a he sort of basically says Trump's a divider and he wants to try and unite the country, but not in a way that means he's soggy and doesn't offer any radicalism. I don't know that much about him.
What seems interesting to me about when he talks is that he talks in a way that certainly appears to be somebody going, well, I'm not just going to give you all the positives about my point of view. I'm going to say, this is what the reality is. And we all know that that's the reality. So here's how we have to approach it. And then he gives you a really cogent, simple, short, intellectual argument that's very persuasive, pointing you in sort of in a progressive direction.
He did this thing, didn't he, when he was asked about the kneeling for the national anthem.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
And he sort of gave an answer about why he thought kneeling was fine, but in a way that was sort of tried to understand what people were thinking about it.
Because the two responses up to that point are this is an outrage, you are traducing the American flag and everything that stands for, or this is about all out struggle. So
the resistance,
the resistance, and all that. And what he was able to do was say, listen. It's more complicated than that, and do it in a way that didn't make people go, oh, is it complicated? Oh, well, in which case I'm going to switch over. He actually made that an appealing
isn't
idea,
the key to
a flattering
isn't
idea.
The key to this, which also speaks to what we've got in this country, is distinguishing the sort of the leaders you don't like from the people that voted for them. And I think that's sometimes a mistake that is made. In other words, it sounds like what this play is doing, not typecasting the people who voted for Trump or voted for Brexit, as opposed to you can have very negative feelings about Trump or Nigel Farage or whatever, but it doesn't mean you then have to have the same negative feelings about the people that voted the way they were recommending, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, there's a thing Chris was saying about the sort of death of shame. I think it's a thing as well about the death of honour. And honour is a really complicated idea, isn't it? Because it's quite a Roman idea, and it feels quite privileged and quite white and quite uncomfortable. And America clearly constructed a lot of it, some of which was theatrical and some of which was real, in the sense of what a presidency was and what their sort of offices and articles of state were. And I think that they're needing to go through a process where they work out what it is again, because it has been completely exploded. And there is something about Beto O'Rourke where you go, he does feel like he's honourable, but in a slightly different way. And I wonder what triggers that and what that might be within him. Yeah. Because it feels like that's a question for our politics as well at the moment.
David's going to tell us who he likes for 2020.
No, but I was going to say, so there was this fear that Trump was just going to trash the office, right? There's something about having Trump as president which would just kind of hollow it out.
And
who would want to be president after Trump? People are desperate to be president after Trump. I mean, I think there's more drive, there's more desire for people to get to Washington. He hasn't drained the swamp, but he also hasn't trashed the brand completely. And I think all of these people think they can rescue it. I mean, I think that's the excitement of this. You've got all these different Democratic candidates absolutely desperate to be president after Donald Trump.
But isn't that on the terms that he laid out?
Yeah, but then I think these other candidates are going to test it. I mean, some Democrats will definitely go the demagogue populist route, and one of them might win. I mean, it's possible that the Democrats will choose a Trumpy candidate, but they might not.
There we go. There's the positive, but they might not.
Josie, why don't you go next? We want the professional class's voice in this.
You're very centrist.
Five.
Yeah, exactly. Alt-centre, eight.
Okay, alt-centre. Where am I? Okay.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Capitalists control Congress.
Now, I think that if you're not a capitalist royalty, you might get the assets or the debits, I think.
Okay, well, I'm the professional class and capitalists get two assets.
I think you get two assets.
Do I?
Yeah.
Okay.
How do people...
You must have the assets?
Otherwise...
Power?
I'll take two.
Right.
Two assets, yeah.
David, why don't you go next?
Can I just ask? Yeah. I don't know if it's a bit late in the process.
It probably is a bit
late.
How
do you know when you've won the game?
Church again.
Church again.
This is a really essential question, Chris.
Right.
People have been puzzling about that for many, many years. Yes.
Okay.
Four, seven. We're all sort of congregating on...
It's because we're not so different after all.
Hang on. Chance... This is me, the shot. I've got a chance for an alliance with the farmers.
So what happens
then? So how do you go about this then?
You sing, the farmers and the shopkeepers must be friends from Oklahoma.
Until they enter into an alliance then, with one of them.
Did you have a lot of visitors as a kid?
Am I allowed to have this?
Ed, it's
can
your
I,
game.
Can I have an alliance? Can I have an... Oh, trade unions are formed. Can I have an alliance with David then? I think let David and I have an alliance.
Let's do that.
Yeah, okay.
So what does that mean?
Well, it's a very dramatic moment in the class struggle, which is the
shopkeepers and the farmers.
And the farmers have come together.
So you've got a sort of cooperative going on.
Yeah, is it cooperative?
Are you basically Riverford?
Well, we're in an alliance. We'll work out what that means.
All right, Chris, we're going to pause here to pick out another topic to be optimistic about. Chris is going to
pick
something
out. These are all written on Christmas labels.
Yeah. It's a nice touch, right?
It's a lovely touch. Yeah. I think it says culture, ironically.
Yes. Culture?
Yeah.
That's a big one. Josie, what's there to be excited about?
So much. I mean, there's loads going on. I think the theatre community that I'm a part of is completely thriving. I am most excited this year by the number of new people who have become artistic directors, partly because I'm stopping being one, but there's definitely been a big influx of new voices and new people in that programming, which is where it really counts if you want to make change there. Fantastic young woman called Lynette Linton, who's taken over the Bush Theatre, which was my former address before the Donmar, and she's brilliant. She's directed this play at the Donmar for us. And Kwame Kwaya Mars at the Young Vic. That feels really exciting. So I think theatre-wise, it's all thriving. There's some really good stuff opened. Subsidised and West End, you can go and see some great plays. I'd recommend them.
Yeah.
Love Island was a big hit this year for me.
Love Island?
Yeah.
Sorry, let me just reread the thing. Culture.
Do you think that's...
Jeff tried to defend Love Island.
Ed was... They asked Ed to go on and not the Love Island itself. Yeah.
Not Love Island itself.
No.
Funnily enough, that's next year, yeah. How do you think culture has coped with the times that we're living in? I mean, you mentioned the play that you've got coming up.
I mean, I think culture sort of is the times that we're living in, you know, because one of the great things about what culture can do, unlike having to get a new government in or go through an electoral cycle, is it can turn around big ideas quickly. So playwrights can write quickly, and television actually is becoming swifter and swifter, I think, in terms of how it gets from development into production. That gap seems to be closing because of the big appetite for it.
I was interested to see your reaction on... So people went nuts on Twitter because they released the trailer for this Brexit film that's coming out on HBO.
That's right.
And you had strong opinions on that.
People went nuts over the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Did they go... Yeah, okay. So firstly, did they go nuts over a trailer?
I mean, like, they just seem very affronted that there was a film about Brexit.
They did feel very affronted that it's a film about Brexit, which I find... I find that really weird just because I don't understand why theatre or television or culture can't form a part of the fourth estate in its function. Like, I don't see why we're not allowed to talk about stuff as it's happening.
Yeah, because we're lovies, that's why. It's very important that lovies don't say anything.
No, that's probably right. But, like, who is going to put the statute of limitations on an event being over before someone can start to write about it? I don't understand. It's crazy. So that was very, very weird. But I think there also seems to me to be, at the moment, a little bit of strange ownership going on around who is allowed to write about Cambridge Analytica. And what's occurring in that? So Ed's raising his eyebrows at me as if going, "Don't say dangerous stuff, Josie." But I think I think that's probably really true. So I think there's a sense in which, and I should say, this is my mate James Graham, and actually we did a show that we started researching back in 2015 called Privacy, in which we went and met some of the scientists who were behind some of the research on which the Analytica stuff was based. And actually at that point, James Graham was saying to me, as we were starting to look at how the internet uses our data, surely people must be using this to influence elections. I'm like, well, let's see if we can get any evidence, James. And we kind of couldn't stand it up well enough to put it in the show other than here are two guys who are stripping your Facebook to tell you what your habits are. But he's been right in the heart of that for such a long time. It's great that he's writing about it, which is, I think, part of this Brexit drama. And the gigantic upset about it that occurred on Twitter, I think it's a weird thing, isn't there? Because it's often the first thing that is said. Then comes a story, then it becomes a Twitter story, and then people attach to it, and then it becomes very heated. So you know, it's a weird thing when the Mary Queen of Scots trailer came out, where people are like, she's not got a French accent. I'm like, watch the film, she speaks French. You know? So it's not...
But do you think I mean, we are all aware now of this sense of intolerance and sort of bitterness. Were people always like this? And now they've got a chance to express it through social media? Or were some people always like this? Or has it got worse?
I think it's a rush to ownership. I think that's one of the things that happens, is a rush to go, I own the opinion about this. I own the right to write this story. I own this part of this narrative. Get your tanks off my intellectual lawn.
But also, the stakes seem impossibly high right now. So people, everything seems existential. People are furious because it feels like we are running, especially now we've got a ticking clock, the great dramatic device. We've got a ticking clock of March the 29th.
Almost as good as class struggle.
Feels like, I mean, it doesn't have quite the highs of class struggle, but it certainly has many of the same lows. I think that it's we all feel like we are, our opinion is either going to come to pass or there will be catastrophe. Right? Everybody believes that on some fundamental level. And so people are screaming louder and louder and louder as the car is getting closer and closer and closer to the cliff. That, I think, is also why people, I completely agree with you about the rush to ownership. Yeah. But I also think that with this specific topic, because actually the whole Cambridge Analytica story has been largely ignored by the government and the rest of the Fourth Estate. I mean, you know, aside from what the brilliant stuff that Carol Cadwalader's doing, this huge story that if it were in another country, we would be going, well, look at those idiots, has been ignored by our government and our opposition and the press. So for Loveys to bring it up, and not only that, but Loveys via HBO, an American stalwart, to do it, seems like, for some people, it seems like, thank goodness that somebody is actually doing that. For other people, it's, we're not supposed to talk about that, because that's, well, shut up! So those people are shouting very loud.
So I think the difference is, it is worse, because every battle people think is the war. You know, there's that feeling, what if this is the one we can't afford to lose? Right, yeah. Because no one knows which is the one that's going to settle it. If you're right in the middle of something which is chaotic and could end up anywhere, there is that absolute fear. What if we sat out the one trivial-seeming fight that actually turned out to be the key fight?
Yeah, right.
And I think that's the thing.
That's why people go nuts over the Newsnight vicar,
part of the thing,
for example.
Over the what?
The Newsnight vicar.
Comes on and blesses at the end of every Newsnight. It's a hugely controversial thing.
It was a woman who was a vicar, or what, she wasn't really, or something.
You could have persuaded me of anything. I'd have believed you. And that's different. Don't you think it's different from even... It's that thing of... Like, at some point, you've got to lose in
feels like
in politics.
Some
fights you're going to lose. And today, there's that thought, we cannot afford lose a single fight.
I took a few months off looking at Twitter this year, and... Because it was like, it's like going on there and it's like somebody's putting a broken bottle in someone's face.
Yeah.
All the time.
I mean, so why did you go back on it then?
I don't know.
For that
I felt nostalgic.
Fight club. Yeah, I think there's also, look, there's a very simple debate in here, whether it's about Brexit or not, which goes, are artists allowed to write about the news?
Yeah, right.
Or like, because there's a big underpinning thing that goes, could you just please stick to daffodils?
No, but and I think most people would say yes in principle. It's just in practice, when it gets to the issue that they feel ownership of, or they feel annoyed about, or they want to make assumptions about James Graham's 2-minute trailer and what it really means. Is it pro-Brexit or something? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. You're shouting fire in my crowded theatre. No, I know, but it just...
So Damon Albarn calls for a citizens' assembly.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Citizens' assembly. Yeah. Damon Albarn calls for it. It's toxic, right?
We get very irritated with artists campaigning about stuff. But I actually can't think of a single thing within the arts, if you want to think of that as a trade, that artists have ever campaigned for that we've succeeded in persuading government to do.
That's a cheery thought.
Yeah, but isn't that interesting? Because that just basically means we're rubbish at campaigning. Yeah. What have we successfully...
Free museums?
Lobbied or campaigned?
Free museums and galleries?
But that really came from the Secretary of State for Culture, didn't it? Rather than from... it's like you go, wow, you know, manufacturing is quite successful at winning this debate. Small business has done this quite effectively.
Yeah.
Actually, it turns out we're not that good at it.
But that's because what happens when we go on strike? Right.
People like, people oh, thank God it's cancelled.
Yeah, that's great.
Quick, stick Netflix on, get a delivery.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. If people making grommets go on strike, you can't make the planes and then nobody's going to fly. Yeah. But if we go on strike, oh no, I'm not going to see an insightful look at the psyche of a middle-aged man again.
You know, it's a terrible thing. Since I've been a director, I've become aware of this, you know, like a sort of party or something, and somebody goes, what do you do? And you go, I'm a theatre director. And this terrible sort of flash of guilt goes across the rise, as if you'd said, I'm a yoga instructor. Yeah. Like, I've not been for months.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, please only go if you want to go. I don't require you to go to the theatre, as Ed knows.
Yeah, indeed.
We need to crack on with class struggle.
Yes.
Right. Chance for an alliance with the professional class.
That's me.
Oh,
yes.
Wait, and who? The capitalist and the professional classes together.
Yes. Well, it's typical, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're going to lose.
You're typical.
Yeah.
The farmers won't get a look in.
Yeah.
So what do we have to do then?
Agree.
I'd like some gigantic tax breaks on my conveyancing.
I tell you, you should be good at this, Dave.
Wow. Are you moving house at the moment, Jason? Okay.
Joe, are you going to offer the gigantic tax breaks?
Yeah, yeah. And then what do I get in return?
Is this stuff that you're agreeing within the framework of the game, or is this just improv?
No, it's actually improv. It's actually bad improv.
Okay. Great. Is that, I mean, is there's that no supposed
improv
to happen?
Oh,
there's no bad ideas. There's a lot of it.
Right. Okay. You're in an alliance. I think, Chris, I think it's you. I think the workers now get to sort of.
What about the workers? Yeah. Okay, six. Where's my little hammer? Here we go. One, two, three. Five, six. And I'm on a blue and pink square, which says natural disaster. So the workers get a debit and the capitalists get an asset because the capitalists are disaster.
I think you get a debit, I'm afraid.
So I get a debit.
Why is natural disaster good for the capitalists?
Because building infrastructure shorting.
In the same way that war is.
Shorting things, the way that Brexit will be good for various people when the pound goes.
Do you think that's, as a historian, David, do you think this is correct? Natural disasters are good for capitalists?
Yes, I'm afraid.
Really?
Don't you think?
Like war. War's good for capitalists, isn't it?
It's not.
No, war is good for the workers in the end.
Is it?
Is it? Because they'll get shot and they don't have to worry about anything anymore.
At the end of it, then they get a better, don't they? A better welfare state.
But that's
you can't advocate for war.
Two.
Yeah.
After, the first one.
There was a better welfare state after the first one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And the second, yeah.
But it's after world. The second one.
Yeah, it's world war.
Was the Arts Council after the Second World War?
Yeah, or think of all those paintings of Spitfires you see in the Sunday magazines. That is
actually true. It was sort of set up to stop people doing Stalinist painting. That's why it's an arm's length body in between.
What, so anti-communist thing?
It's in between government and artists. So, like, we can't just give money direct from government to artists. We need an intermediary. Mm. I mean, it was also to, like, cheer people up and stuff, but, yeah.
Where was it set up?
It was non-political. So, 46, 47, I think, yeah.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah.
David, you haven't picked out a topic from our little festive box yet.
This. Oh, good. Can you guess what it is?
Brexit.
It's the easiest one, Brexit.
Oh, shit.
Reasons to be cheerful about ..
We'll all be dead soon.
Do Brexit.
Suicide.
No, I don't think we should do Brexit.
People are going to start eating stodgy British food again, so it'll be good for suet sales.
Yes, I put all my money into Atora.
Spam supplies.
One for the grannies.
Nothing terrible has happened yet, right?
We haven't left.
Yeah, I know, but
pop.
So maybe nothing terrible will happen.
Okay, good.
Yeah, next year will be worse than this year.
This sounds like the thought process in Chris Grayling's head.
Yeah. No, I can't do that.
There's nothing positive.
There isn't.
I mean, whichever side you're on in this, this is the absolute sweet spot of horror. Don't you
know? Yeah,
could be. This is the low. And nothing terrible's happened yet. I haven't got anything else to
say. We just ruined Christmas for everybody.
No, it wasn't us. I mean, it really wasn't us.
I think sort of the fundamental thing is trying to understand whatever solution you want on Brexit, trying to understand what the other side is feeling. Because I think that's what so many people on both sides don't do. They think sort of, you know, too many Remainers sort of seem to be under the assumption that Leavers are sort of racist or stupid, and too many Leavers are just under the assumption that Remainers are just a bunch of snobs, you know. And
so do you think, because there's a big generational divide, and you kind of always hear these stories. So last Christmas, a lot of families are split down the middle on this because of people over 60 see it completely differently from people under 40. And so the view was just don't talk about it at Christmas. Like, it'll ruin your Christmas. So is your advice this year, talk about it at Christmas?
We talked about it at Christmas last year.
Across the generations?
Yeah.
And was there a big divide?
There's not a gigantic divide, but both my brother and my dad were quite close on it. You know, they weren't ardently, in the end they were Remain, but, you know, I think because my dad's worked in trade all his life, be it thermal underwear or wood.
It's all at the same time.
It's all available to us. But he's got a sort of quite calm view about it. And my brother, who's mainly affected by sort of legislation, as someone who is a lawyer in insurance fraud, again, you know, is that they're not heated about it. So we've had some quite good discussion. Good.
You see, some people propose this Irish solution on this. You know, the Citizens Assembly,
almost the David Albarn solution.
Yeah,
almost nothing with Irish solution as a title has ever truly worked out.
But I just
advocated by the arts community.
But what about an Irish exit? We could do that.
That's perfect. I like the idea in principle. I just don't quite know how you get there. The Citizens Assembly. People from both sides come together, think about what the way forward should be. I really like it at a theoretical level. I don't quite know how in this moment.
Yeah, exactly. Find the point in the Brexit process where people say, what we'll do is just have a pause here and get a Citizens Assembly together.
Whatever happens, there has to be a pause.
It was Christmas.
That's
the other bit that's slightly weird. The cliff edge is there. And yeah, we're taking 10 days off because it's Christmas. Yeah. It can't be that bad, right? If it was that bad, would they break for Christmas?
Nothing about their judgment.
Ed, we're looking at you. Would they break for Christmas?
Because whatever. Theresa May wants to break for Christmas.
How bad
to get her vote
the things
through.
Have to get she's, before they come
But she's
for
running the clock now. This is just another aspect of running
the clock.
Yeah, it's really helpful to her. She's probably going to convert to Orthodox Christianity so that she can keep off till the 6th.
Yeah, I hope she's not listening, but she might think that's quite a good idea.
She's still in a Ukrainian national costume.
Yeah.
Wait, this one.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, chance!
Capitalist
chance!
Okay. Oh, so there's workers' chance and capitalist chance. All right.
Okay.
Workers' chances. Oh,
you are treating your class allies very badly,
yep.
Giving the workers a chance to force a switch in the alliance of any class it chooses.
Farmers.
We're both of us. We're in. Definitely.
Revolution.
Right. Okay.
The farmers, the shopkeepers, and the workers are now together.
Josie, pick us another topic out that
the
we can try and find.
The worst one is gone. They're all now.
Exactly.
Like,
I know.
Like totally children or love.
Democracy.
Oh, you go, I told
David.
You.
David.
Come on.
Let's talk about six-year-olds.
Yes, well, there you go. The good news about democracy.
So you did a whole lecture on this.
Yeah.
You did a lecture last year.
Were you bottled off?
The last year's one was called...
What, sorry?
I was asking if it was bottled off.
Yeah. Last year's one was called How Democracy Ends. And this year's one was Democracy for Young People. I'm much more upbeat than last year. Yeah.
Nice.
Go on, tell us.
The basic line is so much has changed about who we are. Like, so the people who represent us have been the same for 100 years, like 50-year-old white men. And it hasn't really changed much. And we've all changed. So 100 years ago, the political class was just this completely removed thing. They went to university, no one else did. They were well off, most people weren't. Now we're living in a country where... not half, but getting on for half, look at the political class and think they're just like us. Mm-hmm. We went to university, they went to university, they're 50, we're 50. And half the country look at them and think they're not like us. Mm-hmm. And we're never going to get a look in because now like it's half the population plus them. So both sides in this divide have got a reason for thinking that being represented by this group of people doesn't cut it anymore. Mm-hmm. So the ones who say they're just like us think, well, we could do it. And the ones who say we'll never get a look in say we want to say. So there's this drive now, I think, for more participation, more connection with the voters. And broadly, I think it's positive because democracy is stuck. I mean, that's, I don't know what you feel about it, Ed, but that's my view. It's like the institutions haven't changed. The fact that it looks the same. Someone from 100 years ago would look at our politics and think, oh, my God, everything about your society has changed. Everything. And I completely recognise these political institutions. I completely recognise these political parties. I recognise these people. So if we've changed that much, they've got to change too. You can get a majority of people who didn't go to university and you can win. Brexit is an example of that. But if you're in that 18 to 40 group, you keep losing. Right? You can turn out in droves. If all young people voted and all old people voted, the young people lose. Some people wrote to me and said, well, don't drop the voting age to six, just cut it off at 75. Not a good idea. And then when democracy gets stuck, the history of it is you just got to find some people to enfranchise. That's the thing that gives it this kind of jolt of energy. And I had thought, well, we can't do that because we've run out of people to enfranchise. And then, well, no, we haven't. There is this one group that we haven't given the vote to. And why not? There's no risk in it because we'll still be represented by 50-year-old white men because nothing ever changes that. But they will give some energy, excitement, unpredictability, drama. You know, make Christmas debates more interesting if the 6-year-olds also had a vote.
My 8 and 9-year-old would be quite pleased with this.
Yeah, they tend to be when you mention it. They're quite keen.
Yeah.
Now you have to read this manifesto. Oh.
Or not. You're allowed to vote. Yeah, I mean, that's the thrill. Yeah, yeah. You're allowed to vote even if you know nothing and care nothing. You can still vote.
Yeah. Great system.
It's called democracy.
Well,
what are your ideas?
So I have two things that that are not remotely frivolous as suggestions. I believe these things fully. The first is close the House of Commons, sell the one that we've got. We've got a huge.
There's a lot going for that,
right? All of the medieval stuff about the House of Commons, the place is geared to feel like intrigue and make you feel separate. As soon as you step inside, you feel like you're in Hogwarts.
Totally
it's a disaster.
Right.
So at the moment, we're at a point where we can do this because
we're moving out anyway.
Here's what you do. You move to Birmingham. You move to the centre of Birmingham and you don't just build a new... This is my radical bit. You don't just build a new parliament building. What you do... Or rather, you don't build new government buildings. What you do, you can have your new parliament building, but your government building has to be in existing office blocks and it has to be interleaved floors. But so there is a normal business, then a government department, then a normal business, then a government department. All of that to take it out of the pantomime aspect of where it is. That, in conjunction with my second, this is my top pitch. I want to change the electoral system, but not in a kind of we must have single transferable vote or anything like that, because we've tried that recently and that didn't work. So keep first past the post for now, but then this is what happens. Instead of the next morning, all of those people who lost are out of work and these people have got the job, we have a system that's not so unlike the American system. So rather than continuing to sit, what happens is Parliament, the day after an election, Parliament goes into continued recess, where it's in recess for a month, 4 weeks. And for two of those weeks, each person who has just been elected has to live with their poorest constituent. And they do that without support from anybody. They have to live on the money. Their phone is changed. They have to actually exist in that world and understand it. Then after the 2 weeks, they go back. They get a bit of training on what the procedures are and what it means to be an MP. And then they get to sit. That's my pitch.
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I think on this thing about the House of Commons, you're right. I mean, I thought that's partly what you were saying about if somebody came from 100 years ago, they would recognise.
It's extraordinary when you think about it.
Bangs a shoe. Who goes, yeah.
It's not
real. Nothing about that is real. And the instant that happens, it is distancing. No actual human.
Yeah. Sorry, is that your voice?
Yeah.
But
it's awful. It's genuinely awful. Yeah, and the minute it happens, it's so self-pleased. That's the worst of it. Is the minute you hear it, you think, how pleased are they to be with themselves?
And it was set up to be distancing. I mean, that was its rationale, and it doesn't cut it anymore. It's so awful. Like 100 years ago, it was distancing because it was massively distant. And now it's not. It looks ridiculous. Yeah. Like you say, it looks like pantomime because they aren't. What's so special about these people?
Can I ask what's a slightly heretical question? The Scottish and Welsh parliaments don't have that flummery.
Yeah.
Is it any different? I mean, I'm genuinely asking that question.
But if
they've sort of got the flummery a little bit because then people applaud when you sort of...
Yeah, so I think I'm a bit more resigned than Chris. I think it's always going to be a bit like that. You need to get the energy in somewhere else. But you need to make them feel more uneasy.
Do they not? What worries me about it is the failure to understand what that looks like.
Yeah.
how that sounds to people. That is a that is a part that tells a whole. It indicates that they have no, they're tin-eared.
So I agree with that. One of the issues is we do tend to go from naught to the fetishization of ritual within about 14 seconds.
Yeah.
So I think the question about the sort of Welsh and Scottish assemblies is good, because you go, yes, it would remake itself in some way. So what's the check that you hold on that? A bit like in any kind of theatrical practice, how do you start to revise that? Like, what behaviour is learned and what is ritual and what is conferred and what comes from you and your identity? You know, how do you learn those behaviours and how do you unlearn them? There's a theatre practitioner called Augusto Boal. You ever heard of him? He wrote this kind of cool book called Games for Actors and Non-Actors, that basically when people start out theatre directing, everyone goes and buys it from Waterstones because it like gives you exercises you can do in a rehearsal room. But I think I am right in saying, and I hope I've not got this totally wrong, that he actually got himself elected to, I hope it's a Brazilian parliament, I think it's Brazilian, and took his budget and hired a company of actors and went round starting effectively these sort of theatrical exercises, which are all about disruption. What he would do is go into a community and start to play out part of that community's story. So say, I don't know, they want to put a hydroelectric power station there and that's bad for people. Some of the actors play people who are members of the community, and then you encourage members of the community to step in and take over. And he went around this parliament doing that. So that would be another thing you could do. You could just theatrically disrupt the Houses of Parliament.
But do you think democracy, David, is threatened?
Even though it's not been a great year, I think I'm slightly more optimistic than I was. So I wrote this book saying, it's in its, not in its death throes, but it's over the hill. And maybe we've got another 50 years left of doing politics like this, but maybe not much more. I just kind of feel that over the last year, there's that recognition that, because I sort of thought we'd run out of ideas. I mean, it's partly what your podcast is about, right? Genuinely, I thought we tried most of it. We sort of know what works, and that's pretty tired now. And 100 years ago, people could look at democratic institutions and say, well, why don't you try income tax or a welfare state or, you know, all sorts of things, or universal education or sending everyone to university. We've tried most of it, but actually I don't think we have tried most of it. I think there are loads of things that we haven't done.
But we don't keep trying. We could just keep reframing those things.
Yeah.
The minute you say, well, I think we've done it all, you really need to just call Francis Fukuyama and say, Francis, how did that end of history thing work out?
So we do have an episode with him on my podcast this year where he's quite a lot gloomier than I was.
Really?
I think honestly that in this kind of moment, though it looks fairly bleak, sort of short term, this way of doing politics is going to be opened up in the next 5 to 10 years. It has to be. And it doesn't mean it has to end. I mean, I think our big problem is that we think it's kind of democracy or the abyss. You know, it's this or fascism. It's this or the 1930s. And there's this huge spectrum, which is the future. And we're just still on one path, and we're going to move slightly to the left or the right, you know, this way, that way. And it's going to look different, I think, in 10 years.
Me Too is a democratic movement, I think, from my point of view.
Definitely.
It's all about power. People like to say it's all about power. You go, well, actually, it's also all about privilege, isn't it?
Yeah. And democracy is not just that pantomime. Democracy is, you know, it's a whole range of social movements. There's an incredible amount of stuff going on. Which one of is going to be the thing that shapes the future, we don't know. But it's a bit like that thing about Trump. I mean, it's way more open, the ways this story could go, than it looked 5 years ago.
Can I say that while Dev has been giving his brilliant insight, Ed has just quietly handed everyone a tangerine?
Yeah, with that glaze.
No.
You didn't ask.
No.
You didn't look at me.
Yeah. You said that.
Oh, and you did hand me one. I noticed you also handed me one, so it's not quite as personal as it seemed.
You said that historically the thing to do has been to enfranchise somebody new.
Yeah.
So we're sitting with somebody who did exactly that.
Right.
This is precisely what you did to the mm-hmm. Labour Party to mm-hmm. invigorate that mm-hmm. was the mm-hmm. enfranchising of mm-hmm. huge numbers of people. So, and we arrive now at a situation where we have the front bench that we have and momentum largely in charge of the party, or at least largely, you know, threatening to deselect and all of those kinds of things. Is that, I mean, I'm imagining that's an unforeseen consequence of what you did, or did you always know that that was...
I didn't think I was certain that it would move the party to the left, but I thought to myself, it's not really justified to have the membership, this kind of old style system of an electoral college and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
You need a threshold for the MPs, and then you need to get the membership elect the party.
Yeah.
And you should, and look, nobody at the time thought it was remotely possible to have a membership of 500,000.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, they thought it's complete fantasy to have political parties. No one joins political parties anymore. Now, I think there's a challenge about how you make those members more active, because actually they're a much bigger force. They could be a much bigger force in the community than they are. But I think it's a huge resource and a huge opportunity.
But it, but what's interesting to me about that is that you can.
Maybe it had unforeseen consequences. Oh, I mean, that's the point.
It certainly had unforeseen consequences, and that's the interesting thing about because what you were doing something from. From the point of view that you just explained, it makes complete sense. And I suppose I'm saying that, yes, to your point, it certainly has reinvigorated. That act of mass enfranchisement has definitely reinvigorated, one way or another, the body that led to conflict. Yeah, and has led to conflict. I guess what I'm saying is you don't know what's going to happen when you do it.
No, and that's part of the point. That is what gives it the energy. Mm. And I mean, that seems to be the difference. I mean, it's not a frivolous point, like lowering the voting age to 16, which is a very sensible idea. But I think it's kind of predictable what would happen in a way. And also, I don't think there are enough people there to actually tip the balance.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the point of saying lower the voting age to 6 is you do not know what would happen. You genuinely don't know. It would be surprising in all sorts of ways. And that is net good.
So we've been running a project at the Donmar where every time there's been a general election, we've gone to, in the first instance, a group of 5 and 6 year olds, and interviewed them. We'll share it with you. We've got a bunch of stuff that we just took in kind of documentary sense. And
Dave's looking nervous.
No. A few people have been doing this, and the results tend to be exciting.
Yeah, we did.
He says nervously.
So the first time we did it, what was really interesting is that it was. So we run like workshops to kind of get the idea embedded. And what we couldn't do was go look at this policy or what do you think of your government, or none of those ideas quite landed with a six-year-old. Mm-hmm. What did land was this sort of drama exercise that we did where we were like, imagine an island. And how would you like the island to be run?
Yeah, right.
And what's your sense of fairness on the island? And who are the people on the island? And what do you want the schools to be? And then immediately they were in and they got it. So I understand what you mean where you go, let's reconceptualise the way in which we talk about the terms of it. And the kind of imagine an island at this moment in our political history doesn't sound like too terrible an idea.
And also, it does connect with the Cambridge Analytica thing, because people say, well, children are too easily persuaded, they're too vulnerable, they'll be exploited. And we take the protection of children seriously. We would, mm-hmm. Now, if children had the vote, we would take pretty seriously what counts as political advertising.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
And in a way, it's not... It doesn't follow, I think, that the adult world would infect the child world. It's possible that the child world would kind of improve the adult
also,
world.
Also, tiny polling booths. Everyone just hold that in there.
It would be cute.
And cheaper. But they do, whenever there's an election or indeed a referendum, it turns out, they do a mock version at my kids' junior school. And those children take it unbelievably seriously. So from 7 to 11, the kids in that school, and they took it, they did far more research, took far more seriously than many of the people bringing them on the school run. It was remarkable. They definitely, you know, given responsibility. Kids love being given responsibility.
And politicians going into schools trawling for votes would be more careful about what they said. I mean, it's just a worse look.
Yeah.
And so why not?
A Chris Addison, David Runciman coalition... It's a very exciting process. It's happening here on the board.
It was
a class struggle.
It's the farmers and the shopkeepers advocating votes
for children. That's what we take from this.
That was what was missing from the original.
The workers. He's the workers.
What next? Ed, I think you should roll.
I think I should roll, actually. But we're not alone.
For a while.
No, that's not one.
Oh, sorry. That's the...
Okay.
Yeah.
5. Government orders the destruction of all copies of Dangerous Game Class Struggle.
Leading to bankruptcy.
It may be too late, however. I mean, I think that's slightly self-referential.
Oh, God.
That comes after nuclear war as well.
Right, to land on the Revolution Square,
right,
a class has to get an exact number on the dice, blah, right? In Revolution, the points of one's allies only count if they've arrived at the Revolution Square, blah, blah. If the capitalists land on square 81, this triggers off nuclear war, slightly unfortunately, and brings an automatic end to the game.
Oh.
Well, that would be fairly disappointing if you got sort of.
Yeah, but
all
I think
that's,
that is the least that nuclear war would be. In real life, you would be at
probably
least
right.
A bit disappointed.
I think you're probably right. David, you roll.
Farmers rule. Lead.
I think revolution. Right, it's revolution. Right. Well, we count up our things. So I think it's you count up your things and we count up our things.
Okay.
Well, we've got four assets. How many have you got?
Nine.
Nine. Ooh. So we've got 13. I think we've got 13.
We also have 13.
Oh! Oh!
Once again, the nation is almost exactly divided.
So we go back to the beginning.
And that's politics. Happy Christmas, one and all.
Very good.
That was exciting.
In the aftermath of revolution, we should finish for Christmas with a reason each, a reason to be cheerful each. Chris, do you want to start?
We're not dead yet.
That's good.
How about that?
I'm taking that one.
David?
Oh, so it's better than that class war world. Like, that was the 1978 world. Some of that seems a bit...
Yeah,
a bit
dry.
Yeah, and... Yeah. And
complicated.
And oppressive.
And unplayable.
Yeah.
If our world is not that world, that's...
Also, not enough pictures, I think. That's one of the things we've discussed.
Yeah, I found playing class war cheery experience because...
things aren't that bad.
Bit dated.
Yeah. Josie?
I think it's a very good world for my world of culture. I think it has been. I think people have had lots of opportunities to make stuff and say stuff and do stuff. And I also, this is very, very personal, but I've had a little niece. It's the first grandchild.
Congratulations.
Delilah. It's just incredibly joyful to be able to, yeah, nice. Just look at a baby. It's really good. I'm nice. Very pro it.
I did. When all of the sort of screeners come through for BAFTA and so on, it's really remarkable. It's a step change in terms of representation, I think, in the wider culture. The number of sort of front-running films that are basically led by women or by people from, you know, black and ethnic minorities. So it's fantastic, actually. It's noticeable. It's a notable change within 12 months, I think.
Yeah, I managed to... it was very hard, actually, to persuade the producers in the studio to let me put people of colour in a Renaissance story in roles we knew were white, and they were just very pro. And they were like, yeah, fine, I feel like that's changing. What's happening is, on screen, and it's been like this in theatre for a long time, is people are just admitting their imaginations to representation, and people of colour will start to play roles that have conventionally and entirely been cast as, you know, white men and women, and that's... great, because we make everything else up. So, you know, let's just open that up.
Ed, what's your
reason? I've got two.
From the year?
Yeah.
A whole year and you've got
to show up. Well, the first is Ireland. Equal marriage last year. Yeah, abortion this year. Yeah. I mean, and I think if you said 20 years ago, that's going to happen, people would have said, well, no, that's not going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to happen in Ireland. And I think what's really interesting about it, and I think it's it would be worth getting one's head around how this has happened, it seems to have happened without massive aftermath, a massive aftermath of bitterness. I mean, it seems to have just happened. I mean, maybe we just don't know, but it seems to have happened.
The legislation's
now been just this week, I think, being passed, implementing it.
Yeah, right.
And it doesn't seem to be, you know, it seems to have been settled.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's kind of good.
That is amazing.
Yeah. And my other one was a cultural one, actually, which is Killing Eve.
Oh, so good.
Brilliant, Killing Eve.
It's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Right, Jeff, you get the last word.
Oh, God. We've just had so many great ideas on the podcast this year and so many causes for optimism in the way that we can improve the country and democracy. But I think the one that stands out for me the most is when I checked into the Holiday Inn in Salford in October, I was made guest of the day. They said, welcome, you've been selected to be guest of the day. And I think that is my great moment from 2018.
That makes everything okay, doesn't it?
Phew.
Should we say thank you?
Yes.
Thanks, Josie, David and Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks to Bert Lohmann for Classroom.
Yeah. Bless him.
Workers of the world unite. Now throw that dice.
Roll on next year.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.